So our access economy segment, we've been looking at popular share companies and what they've done or haven't done to make their services accessible. Today in part three, we're going to be speaking with Shrin Madhapalli. He's the former CEO of Accommable. Accommable is the Airbnb for wheelchairs and was recently acquired by Airbnb. Before we get into that, though, we are going to go to a song. Today's songs also, we are featuring a few artists with disabilities. So our first song, Make You Stay, is by Emma Cooper Williams, and she's a singer-songwriter and disability mentor from New Zealand who lives with cerebral palsy and complex regional pain syndrome. This is Make You Stay.
Words to make you stay. You were outspoken. I was broken. Together we were so words to make you stay. Time passes slowly while we're waiting. But if we hold on, we can stop the memories from fading. Looking for the right side of what's left between me and you. I wish I could find the perfect words. I'm looking for the right side of what's left between. I'm gonna make you stay. 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 I'm gonna make you stay.
Cross-Cultural Dialogue proudly introduces its new project, Baldwin and La Fontaine, Towards Responsible Government. With your family, friends, and classmates, learn more about the role played by those important figures in shaping Canadian government as we know it today. Visit baldwinlafontaine.ca to discover clips, documentaries, and a teaching guide. Enter the National Web Contest for a chance to win a trip for two to Toronto or a post-secondary scholarship.
Shrin is the founder and former CEO of Accommable, an online marketplace for people with disabilities and senior citizens. The website assists those with mobility issues in finding accessible accommodations when traveling. Recently, however, Accommable began a partnership with Airbnb. Shrin is a former corporate lawyer who has a degree from King's College London and Oxford University. He is also a wheelchair user and vivid traveler. Now, a self-taught coder who serves as a product manager at Airbnb. Hope you enjoy this interview.
Just to start things off, so we know you came back from South Korea for the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. How was that?
It was an absolutely incredible experience to go to Pyeongchang for the Winter Paralympics. I was incredibly fortunate enough to be one of the torchbearers as well, and it was a great honor to be able to do that.
So besides doing the torchbearer, was there anything else that you were doing there?
A mixture of things. So we were kind of showcasing and promoting the work regarding accessibility that we were that we're currently undertaking, and talking to lots of media outlets. We did a presentation with the Korean Ministry of Tourism, and actually also had a day of going to see some events down at the Paralympics. And essentially, it was just to raise awareness and promote the work we're doing while the spotlight was on disability.
Nice. So you got to carry the Paralympic torch. Congratulations.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
That's huge. I mean, can you maybe tell us how that all came about?
So, I mean, essentially, it was sort of invited by the local organizing committee, who Airbnb are a partner of. Was invited to come join as one of the torchbearers, and naturally I was delighted to accept the invite.
And how did you feel carrying the Paralympic torch?
Yeah, it was an amazing honor. And like, coming from the UK, so the Paralympics started off in the UK, so it was really nice to be a part of it.
Nice. So what does it mean for you both on a personal level and as someone who works to make travel more accessible to be able to carry the torch?
I think the most important thing is that it creates awareness of what we're doing, and it really allows kind of the spotlight to be shone onto an area that often people don't think about. So being able to promote our work while being a torchbearer and sort of within the kind of the umbrella of the Paralympics just meant that we could really kind of convey some of the message that we're trying to get across about the importance of accessibility.
Can you tell us a bit about your startup with the Accommodable?
Yep, sure. So this was in the summer of 2015 when I started it. So essentially I was, I just worked on a couple of major freelance web development projects. I was looking for kind of an interesting problem to solve. From personal experience, I knew that accessible travel was really problematic. So I took 6 months off to go traveling back in sort of late 2010, early 2011. I took some time off work to do that. And while I had the most amazing experience, I often turned up to places that were just inaccessible, even though various online resources said that there was accessibility. And so it had been something that I'd been pondering for a while. So when sort of the time and opportunity came, essentially it was a case of, oh, you know, let's see whether we could build a useful online marketplace product for accessible travel. And so at the beginning, it was more like as a fun project to see whether we could solve a problem. And then, you know, I sort of prototyped the first version just sort of literally out of my bedroom and then sort of sent it around to lots of people I knew on social media for feedback, and then things started to take off from there and realized that we'd really struck a chord with people and we're really solving a real problem that people cared about.
So with the traveling and starting a combo, was that when it clicked to you to merge your university skills in entrepreneurship and corporate law and work it with disability?
Completely, and I think, you know, it was a sort of a process that sort of evolved gradually. So when I did my MBA at Oxford, like entrepreneurship was a major part of it, and sort of learning how to take things from the idea stage and how to execute them, how to raise money. I think the other aspect of Oxford is that there's a major element about creating startups that have social impact on the basis that startups that do create social impact and generate the most long-term value for everybody concerned. So all of that thinking and all of that learning went into the building of Accommable.
For our listeners who may want to jump into the business disability and lifestyle, would you be able to share your story about how you were able to achieve all your successes from your education in King's College and Oxford to Accommable and now Airbnb?
In terms of like some of the learnings, like the key things is like you mentioned about sort of the my university experiences.
Yeah.
The key sort of takeaway from that time was to focus heavily on sort of building like my skills of analysis and like working on projects that I think were both interesting but also intellectually very stimulating as well. The other bit of it that was really important to me was getting to know other people that were really talented and motivated, and sort of just working with them on interesting things. And then that later on made it much easier to start a business just because I'd already worked with people earlier on who were really talented and could provide really good advice and feedback.
And you mentioned that you do some projects, or you were involved in some projects. What are some of those projects that you worked on?
I mean, say university. So, for instance, there was a startup incubator at Oxford, and I helped get the incubation program up and running. Uh-huh. And that was helping students with ideas turn their work into a commercial reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it was getting an incubation program up and running, and that was, again, a really amazing experience. And it sort of exposed me to a lot of new technologies and also really hit home how technology can scale and really kind of make a difference to a large number of people.
Your company just was acquired by Airbnb, so congratulations on that. Why did Airbnb choose to buy a company like Accommable?
So I think it's a mixture of reasons. I think everyone realizes that this is a really important and sizable marketplace. So the World Health Organization estimates that 15% of the world's population has a disability. And fundamentally, sort of Airbnb's mission is to create a world where anybody can belong anywhere, and that includes creating a platform that people with disabilities can use as well. So this was something that the company had been thinking for a while, like how they could do better. And I suppose from their side, it was actually, why don't we work with sort of the leaders in this market, which we were. And from our side, you know, we wanted to scale out what we're doing. I mean, we were a relatively small team and company, and we had sort of ambitions to do what we were doing on a much larger scale. And so being able to use Airbnb's infrastructure and global reach meant that we could use our expertise, which Airbnb needed, and work with the company to create like something on a more global level.
So what are some new changes in accessibility we can expect to see from Airbnb?
So as you we announced a few days ago 21 new accessibility filters for things like roll-in showers, step-free entrances, that replaced the original wheelchair accessibility, the old wheelchair accessible filter. So we are creating filters that are much more granular than before.
Mm-hmm.
However, that's just, you know, the beginning. We are thinking long and hard about how we can improve this for people with other types of disabilities. We are also, we announced that we're creating like an accessibility collection on Airbnb. So homes that we know have really good access, we'll be sort of creating a special collection on the platform to make those homes more easily searchable. And then the other sort of big area that we're looking to kind of improve is to try and increase the number of people with disabilities actually hosting their homes as well, and just making sure that our host community is as inclusive as possible.
So in your opinion, what kind of insight as an avid traveler in a wheelchair, do you bring to Airbnb?
So I think it's that personal experience of what is needed to make accessible travel as easy and straightforward as possible. it's understanding what kind of features and amenities a person with a disability would be looking for, but also how to create the trust that the information you see on a listing is good enough so people can actually see that information and say, yes, I can go ahead and book.
With that next question, what is Airbnb learning from Accountable's organizational culture?
I mean, a mix of things. I think one, you know, just the actual product. We are sort of trying to transfer the knowledge and expertise we have on how to make a product accessible for travel purposes. I think the second thing is we're also working with parts of the company in terms of like human resources and recruitment on how to make sure Airbnb can be the best possible employer for people with disabilities. And again, sharing our experience of how we recruited people with disabilities at Accountable.
Sounds good.
Awesome. So you've traveled quite a bit. With that, in your opinion, which city or town is most accessible for tourists with disabilities?
Oh, that's a difficult question. But there's so many interesting cities around the world. But, I mean, I don't think that anywhere in the world is absolutely perfect, but if I was to choose a favorite city for accessibility, it would probably be Barcelona. It's really easy to get around transport-wise. There is accommodation available, and yeah, it's just a beautiful city altogether.
And I guess turning that on, what was one of the least accessible favorite cities?
I think, you know, it rather than something specific, like I think, yeah, traveling to parts of the world that are less economically developed can be harder just because the infrastructure is often older or not as developed. That often makes things very difficult. Or traveling to places that are extremely historic just because, you know, you're dealing with old buildings, things haven't been modified, that can always be really challenging as well.
Yeah, so that's actually moves on to my next question. What kind of problems have you come across while traveling in a wheelchair?
I mean, it's come across sort of all sorts. Like, you know, you turn up to restaurants and cafes and like the steps to get in,
right,
or, you know, finding taxis or finding other transport can be really hard.
Yeah.
So I guess, and every sort of point of the journey there have been challenges and things often, you know, problems often arise, but sort of when there's a will, there's a way, and you try your best to find a solution.
Kind of reflecting that back on Airbnb, what are some challenges that your company and your work has kind of faced in making Airbnb more accessible?
And yeah, I think, you know, the challenge is, you know, we are working with a platform that already has over 4 million listings, and sort of, you know, integrating that across a large entity does create its own challenges. I think the other thing as well is that we want to spend a lot of time educating hosts on accessibility,
right,
to make sure that we are recruiting good properties and, you know, educating people into the world of accessibility who may not be as familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's an amazing opportunity, but equally it is also a challenge.
And you were mentioning about actual hosts being those with the disabilities. In what ways are you working to accommodate hosts who have disabilities who want to have an Airbnb?
Yeah, so for hosts, I mean, they now have all of these new amenities and features that they can select on their listings. We're also looking to create partnerships with disability organizations and community groups who can help us reach out to people. And so we're looking to start building those relationships in order to recruit more hosts with disabilities.
And is this, in terms of the accommodations that are being made, are they specifically for people with physical disabilities in wheelchairs, or does it extend to other disabilities as well?
At the moment, there is more of a focus on wheelchair accessibility.
Okay.
However, one of our key sort of objectives over the course of the year is to make sure we can expand this and include other kinds of disabilities. So it's one of our high priorities.
Hi, everyone. For people who are just tuning in, this is All Access Pass on CITR. That was just an interview with Shrein Medhapalli. He is the founder and former CEO of Accommable, which is basically the Airbnb for people with disabilities. So we are now going to play two songs for you, Love Me Right by Amber Mark and I'm Blue by Kimoral. And when we come back from the break, we are going to have an interview with mothers advocating for medical use of marijuana. Stick around.
Tell me, because I've said it all. I've got a feeling we must have hit a wall here. And baby boy, please tell me like it is. 'Cause you talk love, but you never act on it. Because the driving is alive and honey, it is calling you. Three.
The Leo Ramirez Show at CITR, Mondays from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. El show de Leo Ramirez en CITR, lunes de 5 a 6 de la tarde.
Number one, now I'm roasting under blazing sun, riding shotgun, you at the wheel, my free will at your direction, memorize your signs, but forgot my own reflection, all my eggs in my basket, I gave them all to you, still hungry after fables, but I ran out of spoons, give her more than I can give, overextending my wings, good at playing your games, but this is not a win-win, I've been sickening your dirty dishes, even when my place full, I marry myself, I remain faithful, one day I'll leave the table, cause you stop serving love, crave the taste of solitude, I know it is enough, I'm blue, the color of my solitude. How many times I knew my yes was a no? I'm your clown out of habit, there is dust on my throne. For you, I drop my shit just to hear you say hero. Fly you to your dreams, distract me from my own. Maybe, baby, someday I will learn to be alone. I fly myself up to the moon and build a gate around my zone. I bust a myth that I am selfish when I take care of myself. Repeat it till I hear it, reverse the trauma in myself. Ooh, ooh, the color of my solitude.
Hi, everyone. For everyone who's tuning in, this is All Access Pass on CITR. We just had two songs, Love Me Right by Amber Mark and I'm Blue by Kim Wardle. We are now going to go to an interview with Mama. This is Mothers Advocating for Medical Marijuana for Autism. That is a correction from what we said before the break. Important correction, our bad. So we are going to be interviewing them. They are a group that is based out of Texas and are a grassroots parent advocacy group whose primary goal is the legalization of medical marijuana with autism as a qualifying condition. So our collective organizer, Desi, spoke over the phone with one of the co-founders, Amy Liu, on February 16th, 2017.
Hi, you're listening to All Access Pass. I am here with Amy Liu, who is a part of the Mothers Advocating for Medical Marijuana for Autism. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do, who you are, what's the organization you're involved with?
Sure. So I'm Amy Liu, and I'm from Texas, and I have a 17-year-old son with autism, and he's kind of what we call a non-responder. So even though we knew he had issues from before he was two and have been giving him all sorts of appropriate therapies, you know, from behavioral to playtime to nutrition to biomedical. We've done all the major stuff and then some. We've never really been able to move the needle as far as getting to any core symptoms. He's pretty much the same kid he was at age two as far as autism goes. And there's still a long ways to go with his behaviors and his level of anxiety that I've never been able to, you know, make better. They just continue to get worse.
Right.
So with a child like that, you know, regardless of your belief system or any preconceived ideas, I always say you just think out of the box when you have a sick kid.
Right.
And so autism parents are famous for scouring the internet for what might help their child. And it started at least 10 years ago looking at, we'd like to say cannabis, not marijuana, cannabis for autism. And I definitely found a couple stories that were very, very encouraging. Some of the old timers, a boy named Sam, a boy named Alex, and a boy named Joey. But then over the span of 8 years, I never saw any new stories. And I thought, well, if this works for autism, with given that the tidal wave of children with autism happening, surely we'd be hearing more. And so I kind of just let it go.
Right.
But I think people don't talk, or in those days didn't talk about it because of the illegal nature and controversial nature. Even in Colorado, there's some fear of giving it to children, stuff like that, until Charlotte's Web happened.
Right.
And Charlotte's Web is a strain named for a little girl who was having 300 seizures a week. The parents asked for cannabis oil, and it immediately put her seizures down. Well, it's just a drop under the tongue and no bad side effects. And immediately she was down to one or two seizures a week. And she's made wonderful progress since then. It's been a number of years. But what that interview said that caught my attention and my co-founder's attention of Mama was it improved her developmental delays. And autism is a developmental delay disorder. And we're like, it can work for autism. It might work for autism. And so that was, I founded it along with a friend of mine, and we're like, well, let's start a group. And that was exactly 3 years ago.
Wow.
So we formed MAMA as an advocacy group in Texas where it's illegal to use marijuana or cannabis medicinally. I'll explain more about that later. It's almost completely illegal. But so we just started a group, and any success we've had, I think, is just because we're in the right place at the right time. Right. Autism is overwhelming the nation. Cannabis is coming in, and it can't be stopped at this point for medical cannabis. So my husband calls us lightning in a bottle. We just captured a moment, and Mama has been, from being a little two people from a church talking about it online to we have a Facebook following of over 11,000 people, which I know that's kind of not a real thing, but it's just Facebook. But we also have MAMA chapters in a dozen states in the United States. We've talked to people from all over the world. People have reached out to us more than daily to talk about this. So that's kind of how MAMA started.
I didn't know that. So you were one of the founders of it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So how did you find that, like, when it was taking off? How did you find that there was, how were you able to, like, connect with these other mothers? And what was kind of, like, the push for you to continue with it, I guess?
Well, we just started going to meetings of other cannabis advocacy groups. And literally there's a lot of groups out there there's a couple big groups that are fighting for cannabis reform across the board. And we're just for medical, but that was really, they gave us a really good start just meeting people because they already had a platform to speak from. And when we came in and said we were mothers of children with autism advocating for medical cannabis, they literally cried because there are so many patients represented in that organization. You know, there's a lot of recreational use, I would guess, or at least some of it is self-medication, but that's another story. So anyways, they gave us our first platform and invited us to speak at their march and all that, and we knew nothing pretty much then, but they were just happy to see our, you know, hear our hearts and where we were going with this. So we just plugged into existing groups. But then, like I said, Mothers for Autism are scour the internet, and word just got out. And my co-founder is she had a lot more autism connections in the medical world than I did. So we got to talk about it at some big medical conferences right away. So that's how we kind of got our foot in the door of advocacy.
And with, you were saying your co-founder being more involved with the medical context, do you find that there's resistance specifically to where you're situated in Texas, where you said it's almost illegal? Did you find that there was resistance from doctors, from the medical community?
Both. There is and there isn't. Doctors are not taught about this in school, and so there's a lack of clinical studies for cannabis in the United States because it's a Schedule One substance.
Right.
So
could you explain a little bit about what Schedule One is for people who we don't know what it is.
In the United States, the prohibited drugs, there's a different word for it I can't grasp think of right now, there's a five-tier schedule, and at the top of the list are
No worries.
You might need to edit.
Yeah, no worries. It's right in good time.
Sorry. Okay, I'm just going to... I don't know how to make that stop until it stops.
Okay, no worries.
I think it's almost done.
Okay.
I'm going to I'll unplug it in here.
Okay. Okay, awesome. I'm just going to write down. Okay, cool.
Ask me that question again? I don't even remember what it was.
Oh, sorry. It was what is a Schedule One drug?
Oh, a Schedule One drug. Okay, got it.
Right, and then before that, I had asked what has been the reaction from the medical community that you guys sympathize with, right?
Okay. So I'll talk about a Schedule One drug. In the United States, there's a hierarchy of illicit drugs, and the top of the list contains heroin and things like that, and marijuana. And the reason it's there is they claim there's no medical benefit from marijuana. Cocaine is on that as well. Then, that's the problem doctors have is, one, they've been taught it's an illicit, dangerous, non-medical drug from years of propaganda and medical school. And secondly, there's because it's a Schedule One drug, you can't do research about a Schedule One drug except if you're trying to prove that it's bad for you.
Right.
So there's been lots of studies trying to show how bad cannabis is for us. And I think specifically of the study where they found out it kills brain cells or makes your IQ drop or something. But that's for somebody that's smoking it frequently throughout the day and they're making a lifestyle choice for years to do that.
Right.
So, yeah, I think if you sat on the couch and drank alcohol, you know, three times a day for years, you'd probably have a few brain cell issues. Anyways, that's the problem doctors have. If they're, I think some have experiential knowledge of it, because I've heard of patients where they had cancer and the doctor said, just please go find some cannabis and to help with your symptoms, your nausea and being sick after chemo. So there's those types of doctors. And then there's doctors that are open to it. And they are willing to testify and they are willing to speak publicly about it.
Right.
So it kind of runs the gamut, but more doctors are against it than for it at this point, or at least more are quiet about it than vocal is probably a better way to say it.
Right. And have you found that with other mothers that you've talked to, that that's something that they have to deal with, where maybe their doctor of their child is against the medical use of marijuana?
Yes, and this is where we have to keep in mind that in the United States, we have to think about which state is it legal and which state is it not legal. So in the non-legal states like Texas, doctors aren't even allowed to talk to you about it. Otherwise, they can get in trouble. They cannot suggest to you that you should try it.
Right.
But in the legal states, it can be difficult. You have to have one or two doctors, depending on the state, sign off on a recommendation for your child to use it. And even in Colorado, it can be hard to find a doctor who's willing to do that for a child.
Right.
So we have a lot of work to do to really make it safely legal and getting help from doctors, which is what one of our principles at MAMA is, to have a doctor's guidance. But not only, this is interesting, not only are doctors not allowed to talk about it, even if they are the ones that write the recommendation, I don't know if it's in all the states, but in most of the states, they're not allowed to then continue to guide you. All they can do is recommend it. But then they're like, sorry, I can't advise on strains or dosages.
Right, so they just say that it's okay to take. But then I know, like, from the research that we did do, that it's important what type of strain it is.
Oh, absolutely, and that's a huge subject, too.
Right.
So, but the point with the doctor is that autism is so complicated. Otherwise, we'd have sort of a, you use this, and then that's what you try. And there's endless number of things to try with autism because there's not one autism type, you know, so different things work for different kids, and it's the same with cannabis. Different strains are going to work with different kids, and we would really like people to become experts that can guide us, especially on children that are difficult. Like my son is, I'm sure he's going to be, because things don't work for him. So I think there's going to be different types of kids as far as cannabis intervention goes too. I know people who are getting it illegally, and they don't really worry about their source. As long as it's clean, they don't worry about what strain, and everything works for their kid. And then there's other children I've heard of in legal states where they have the ability to sort of try strain after strain, and it takes multiple strains before they find one that actually helps.
Right, right.
But even if something isn't helpful, and like CBD oil, for instance, that is legal for me to try with my son. It makes him worse. But it doesn't make him worse for more than a day. It's safe. He has a bad day, and I'm like, okay, well, that's not working for him. But right. There's not like, I gave my son risperidol, which is one of the two FDA-approved drugs for irritability in autism. And within 36 hours of a low dose of risperidol, my son opened his mouth and started wagging his tongue back and forth with like a tick.
Right.
And we stopped it immediately because ticks can be a permanent side effect from risperidol.
Okay.
They don't have to be, but they can be. And after a less than a two-day trial, it took at least 6 months for that tongue tick to go away.
Oh, wow.
So that's dangerous. Right. Cannabis is not dangerous. Right. And that's one of the big things that puts people's fears at ease, but it's still not enough for doctors to embrace it sometimes.
Right, and like you were saying, it seems like with trying different strains, that's definitely somewhere where they could grow, and maybe like clinical trials could, if there wasn't as many limitations, maybe there wouldn't be as many difficulties trying to match a strain to the child, I guess.
Yes, I would think that, you know, it's the same in treating autism. Let's say there's, I'm just making this up, a dozen subtypes of autism. There's a gut kid, a viral kid, you know, an inflammation kid, all those different types or different diets work. I think it'd be the same for autism. With cannabis, I think you could probably identify a dozen strains that in general, if your kid is like this, he's going to need this strain. But an overriding principle is that children with autism are going to need access to the whole plant. So I don't know if you and your audience knows that we have CBD, high CBD laws in the states, in about a dozen states now.
Okay, no, we do not.
Okay, so what they're doing in these really conservative states to try to help some people but not let in the big monster of marijuana into your state is they limit what part of the plant you can access.
Okay.
So cannabis has over 400 chemical compounds. Over 100 of those are cannabinoids. So the cannabinoids, of those 100 or so cannabinoids, the most famous or the most popular one before the medical part came is THC. THC is what gives you the psychoactive effect.
Right.
Other ones do slightly, but THC is the biggie. So so states don't want to have anybody pretending they're sick so that they can have access to another drug to use. So what they do is they say, okay, we can have the whole plant, everything else, but it can't have more than 0.5% or some percentage that they, it's an arbitrary number that states go from 0.3% to about 5% THC that are restricting it. And so these are the Bible Belt conservative states that the conservatives just have a hard time getting past the propaganda that they've been taught for years. And I sympathize because I'm one of those conservatives. I'm a very conservative Christian Republican that lives in Texas, and I'm good with all that. But so I understand that it's hard, and that's why I go back to my original statement of when you have a sick kid, you got to think out of the box.
Right.
So that's why.
Right. I think you were touching on this before, and I just wanted to segment over here. You're saying some of the goals and focuses of MAMA. What are some of the goals you guys are hoping to achieve right now? So what are some of the action points that your group is carrying on at the moment?
Well, there are so many potential goals, but there's a couple things that I think are really important right now. We're from Texas. The founders met in Texas, and we're in a legislative session right now. So we're kind of hunkering down and focusing on just trying to get a whole plant bill that includes autism as a qualifying condition.
Right.
Because if you don't have a qualifying condition, you can't get a recommendation anyway. So, and there's a bill that's been introduced. So I spent the day at the Capitol with about 20 other mamas just advocating for this bill that would cover autism with the whole plant.
Right.
So a big focus right now is just in our own state.
Right.
but the second focus is in other states where, let's say, a whole plant state like Michigan or Florida or, other states that have whole plant bill now, but autism is not a qualifying condition, we are helping other states write petitions to get autism as a qualifying condition,
right,
providing as much research as we can, and just supporting them, helping them write the petition. And that we've done that a couple times, and that's something I'd really, once the Texas legislative session is over, that's something I'd really like to concentrate on. I know Minnesota next summer is going to be writing a petition, and they've reached out to us, and I'm really hoping that, you know, we can work with them to help them write a petition. We just submitted one. Oh, no, we didn't actually meet the deadline because it's kind of, you know, it's new and it's a little complicated to get all written down, but we just wrote a petition for Arizona that we're going to sit on for 6 months and reintroduce it in the summer because you can only apply a couple times a year in most states.
Right.
Illinois is in a big battle right now to add autism as a qualifying condition. So that's nationally, that's the big thing that we're working on, is helping states get autism as a qualifying condition. But and then goals is just to continue to educate people and educate doctors. We'll have a presence, if not, we do have a doctor speaking at Autism One, which is being held in Colorado Springs in May, and cannabis is a big topic there. So we love to network and put people together that may not know each other,
right,
and just help movement that way. So That's keeping us busy, not to mention all the parents that write us on a daily basis asking for help. And while I can't give medical advice to anybody, I can say join this group or, you know, find this person in that state and things like that. So that's what comes with just with time and growing an organization.
Right, right. And you're saying, so one of your initiatives is to educate, so you go to events. Is there any other ways that you your group educates other people?
Well, we're constantly putting up things on our fan page on Facebook, articles or research that we run across, and we try to give talks. One of our we'll be speaking in April at a TACA conference, which is Talk About Curing Autism. They're a national organization. I recently wrote a couple sidebars in a magazine called The Autism File that is an electronic magazine. And so we're doing that kind of thing. And of course, we, you know, word of mouth, we try to wear our mama shirts, and it's people just stop and ask us. So I find for very conservative people, Christian, you know, organizations and whatnot, they initially think, no way, but I say, if I need 5 minutes with this person, I'll have them agreeing with me, because it's so clearly, in my mind, it's a plant that God made. God made us. We have an endocannabinoid system that has the receptors for not only our endogenous cannabinoids that we manufacture ourselves. There's two. They found a third. There's probably more. But also for the cannabis plant, it's like a lock and key. Our endocannabinoid system is perfect fit for cannabis. That's not an accident,
right?
You know. So as a Christian, I truly believe God put it there for us. And when people withhold this plant, saying it's, you know, I'll pray for you that you get your symptoms, you know, relief for your son. And I'm like, God already answered our prayer, and you're not letting us have it.
Right, right.
So that's, I don't remember the beginning of this question, but that's kind of what we believe. Because we, like I said, we met in church, and this really isn't a problem from a Christian viewpoint.
Right.
So
yeah, in terms of like what other types of feedback have you guys, like, in terms of reception from other people, maybe people that are resistant to it, people like what has the feedback been like to Mama since you began about 3 years ago?
It's been very favorable and encouraging. I think the toughest people to talk to are the doctors that really are looking for that scientific research that they don't accept what's out there yet, even though I believe there's enough research out there if they would just pay attention to it.
Right.
So that's the most frustrating thing. But feedback for us has been very positive. At the beginning, when we hardly knew anything, people were so kind, and just the most important thing about us really is just getting our children's story out there. And so we're an expert on our children. It's a little bit of just talking about what is autism. People don't know. And there's a video. There's all sorts of autism. What cannabis works beautifully for, and that drugs haven't seemed to work consistently or safely for, is when children are aggressive or when they are self-injurious, which means they hurt themselves, they punch themselves, bite themselves, you know, eye poking, you know, things like that, which are really, really sad for anybody to see, but especially a parent. And cannabis works for that. And nobody can argue with that. They can't possibly give us a hard time when we're just trying to help our children. And I think another key thing about positive feedback is we're not trying to sell anything.
Right.
And I think people understand that we're not trying to get anything from anybody. We're just trying to give and help. And so the feedback's been very encouraging. Getting laws passed has a lot, especially a controversial type of a topic. You know, if you can walk in and tell a legislator about your child, they can't argue with you on that. And there's a lot of compassion.
Right.
And actually, sometimes it's misplaced compassion, I like to say, because they're worried about people getting access, and it wouldn't be safe for the general population, in their opinion.
Right.
But they also do. People have compassion for us because our children are hurting and we're hurting.
Right.
So.
Right. So I guess we have to end here. But before we go, I know that you've been you founded the organization and you've been doing this for about 3 years. Have you had any any stories or any big lessons taking away from connecting with other mothers?
Well, it's very encouraging. It's very, parents with autism in the family, we lose hope. And you think after my son's 17, after 15 years of trying everything, I really feel like cannabis is the one thing that can, it can't help everybody because nothing helps everybody, but it can help a lot of kids. And so all the stories I've heard of kids doing great, of like from the moment you give it, you can tell there's a change, they stop being aggressive. All that, all those stories combined just give me hope, and I'm happy for everybody, because when anybody that can help an autistic kid helps that one person, it's all worth it, even for one person. So.
Right. Oh, awesome. So I think that ends our interview for today. Thank you so much for talking with us. It was really great to get, to learn more about MAMA, because I think a lot of people might be a bit, lacking information about autism, about medical marijuana use or medical cannabis use towards autism. So thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you. So if you want to get more information from MAMA, there's a few ways to do that. First would be to look at our website, which is at www.mamausa.org. And there's lots of scientific articles on there, as well as, scientific research and articles just telling you how does cannabis help autism. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/TexasMamas. With an S at the end, and remember, MAMA's with 3 M's. So I hope that you can get some information there, anybody that needs it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to CITR. This is All Access Pass. So that was our interview with mothers advocating for medical marijuana for autism. So that is the end of our episode.
If you are interested in joining our team or think there is an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Thank you to Shrin Mattapalli from Accommable and Airbnb for speaking to us.
Thank you to Amy Liu from MAMA.
Remember to like us on our All Access Pass Facebook page.
And if you're on Twitter and Instagram, please follow us at @Access_CITR.
If you want to hear part 1 and 2 of our Access Economy segment, you can listen to our podcast that shows on CITR.ca by going on the search box and searching All Access Pass. And there you can listen to all of our previous episodes.
And thank you for listening, and tune into our show next week, Wednesday at 4 o'clock p.m.
Stick around for Arts Report, which is up next. Bye, everyone. Take care.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.